So this is the West Coast Project Podcast. It's the last one, Michelle, for True Detective.
I know, I'm a little sad.
And it was broadcast on March 9th. We're at March 31st, so we at least got in the same month.
Barely, by the skin of our teeth, like within minutes.
So I'll ask you again, was this unsatisfying, the ending, for you?
I didn't think so. I mean, there were still some open questions, I think. But
it wasn't too, it didn't come to too quick of a conclusion.
Yes, I think it did. And I think we kind of touched on that a little bit on the previous episode. But all of the information and the information in this one wasn't as overwhelming. I felt like they really took the time to lay it all out. It seemed like a lot longer episode than Episode 7. Episode 7 was a tough one for me. Even though I still thought it was good, but it was tough. I kind of liked it. I thought they did a pretty good job. It's hard to talk about it after the fact. I think it's been hard since we finished it to do episode after episode because we knew how it was going to end. And I think I lose a little bit of my enthusiasm, I think, for it when I know the answer. It's the anticipation of not quite knowing the answer that kind of kept it going. But watching these again, I love the show. Got nothing negative to say. What about you?
So what do you think happens to them in their lives next?
I've got this whole little scenario built up, you know, where Cole joins Marty's private detective team and they solve many, many cases together. What do you think?
I don't know about that. What do you think happens to the Tuttle Big Shot people that they didn't catch?
Not a blasted thing. Nothing. What did you think?
They just roll on relentlessly like all the big powers that be.
Well, I don't know. I just know that, you know, it says later on in the episode when we get to that the Tuttles had some kind of plausible deniability about relations with any of these people or something like that. So it just seemed like that was handled kind of. Why? What did you think?
Well, so we start out at Errol's house. What do you think? Do you need me to squeegee your memory so you don't have those awful scenes in your head?
Remember what we talked about how some things you can't unsee, you know, and I was telling you that, you know, I've told my girls, don't look at some things. We were talking about the baby in the microwave. Some things you just can't unsee. I can never unsee that. And that was so bad. Please.
Yeah, I don't know what you're talking about, which scene, because there are a few of them. But the first one we see is Errol talking to his daddy. And his daddy is, we don't really know it yet, but he's kind of mummified on this table in the house, in the cabin.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't show it. He's just talking. All you can tell, you get to see like an ankle that's tethered down to like a box spring, an open box spring.
Did you think he was dead when you saw that or alive?
Well, I knew he wasn't making any noise and I knew he wasn't moving, but I thought he was alive, maybe.
Yeah, because he says something about, I'll bring you some water at lunchtime or noon or something, or tomorrow.
Yeah, he says something about noon, and then he says something about the flies are getting bad, and you need a good hosing down. And did you know, I couldn't tell when the scene first came on and all the writing is, I mean, every inch of the walls of this cabin is covered in writing. And I couldn't tell if it was writing or blood splatter or paint splatter. I couldn't tell if I was just trying to matrix it and make it be writing. Of course, we find out later that it is. There's a big table beside him that's just covered. I mean, a big, big table that's covered in all of these crude looking, like garden tools kind of things that just don't have a place beside somebody's bed. And the whole thing was just horrific.
Yeah, so Errol goes merrily on his way back into his main house, and we see him watching a great movie, one of the best movies ever, North by Northwest. It's a Hitchcock movie. What did you think of that scene?
Honestly, I had a hard time. I did notice that, but I had a hard time focusing. There was so much to see in that. His house was, Everything in this was a contradiction. He walks out of this cabin into the outside, and the outside's lush and green and beautiful, and he's whistling, and he walks to the big house, and then the big house, when he goes in, is dark and just a hoarder's dream. It is covered, every square inch is covered in stuff, and it's like filthy. And we meet, you know, we hear Betty. Everything about him is just full of, it's just like clutter. Like his mind is cluttered, and everything about him just seems like he doesn't look like he's bathed. I mean, he's just repulsive, and I think his surroundings were repulsive.
Well,
too.
He's very, I agree that he's very twisted, but he's also very intelligent.
Yeah, in a way, yeah, he is, absolutely. In
and
one
he has,
way.
He has a million books, and he has, you know, he has all these different trains of thought and crazy ideas, but he has a lot of intelligence.
Yeah, he does have books, but he also has doll parts laying around and old newspapers and
so what do you think all that, why do you think he had that stuff?
Well, I mean, you know, I think the obvious reason would be to read about the stuff that he's been involved in as far as the old newspapers and stuff. I don't know. What did you think?
Do you think it was to lure the children to the house or to his traps? Or do you think it's stuff he, when he got the children, he kind of collected that from them? Or do you think maybe that when he didn't have children around, that he used that stuff to, like, fill his need to be around children and children toys? And
I kind of looked at it more from Betty's point of view. I thought that might have been the doll stuff, might have been Betty's stuff.
Betty was the sister.
Well, yeah, we don't know that at this point. It's just, you know, she's just, when we're first watching this, we don't know that. We just know it's the female in the house. And I thought maybe she didn't have children, and so that was her thing, was the doll thing. I don't know. But she's kind of crazy because she'd be real loving in one second and talking very sweetly, and then the next thing she'd be screaming at the top of her lungs about the dog being inside or something.
Errol mimics James Mason in North by Northwest, who's playing Philip Van Damme, a character in that movie. And he speaks pretty closely. He, like, really does a really good job of mimicking his accent.
And, oh, is that what he was doing?
Yeah.
I didn't get that. Okay, because he kept changing his accent as the scene went on.
Well, what happened is Nick Pizzolatto explained that part of his creation of Errol was that when his father damaged his face with the scarring in his mouth, mm-hmm. that he had to learn to speak again. So he watched old VCRs and he mimicked people in the VCRs, and that's how he kind of got his voice back.
Ah, okay.
So he had all these movies, old movies of, you know, North by Northwest, I think is from the 50s. And at least he's watching good movies. You know, he's not mimicking crappy old stuff. But that's why he was so good at, you know, he was very, very close to being right on with James Mason's accent and all that.
Well, it's very nice of you to find something positive to say about Errol.
Yeah, so he says Errol consumed a lot of pop culture, and he had stacks of DVDs and VCRs, books and magazines in his house. And that was why, because he was trying to find a way to, I guess, get his voice back.
Yeah, that's, I hadn't heard that one. But that makes more sense, I guess, because I was wondering about the accents and stuff. I think that would have been neat if they could have somehow put that in there for those of us that are not quite as intelligent.
Well, the whole series was kind of an investigative process for the viewers. Like, what you see while you're watching, and then interpret and investigate and, you know, try to figure out what's going on.
Right.
So, another thing Nick Pizzolatto said, which is kind of cool, he said the show is against not thinking. Like, somebody asked him, what's the show about? What's it for? What does it stand for? He said, it doesn't stand for anything. It just stands against not thinking, which I thought was really cool.
That is pretty good. That sounds, so like it was kind of against Marty for the most part.
Well, like, you can't just sit back and enjoy the ride and just watch it and be, you know, entertained by car crashes and fires and bullets blasting away. It's like you had to think to enjoy it, or to, you know, you had to even watch it, you had to think. It forced you to think.
Right. Yeah. To get anything out of it, you really did.
So Errol and his sister, Betty, was her name? Betty?
Betty. Mm-hmm.
I never caught her name, but it's his half-sister, I guess, or another affair that his daddy had with one of the people around him back then. But his, so the lineage is, I guess his grandfather was Sam Tuttle, and his daddy was William Lee Childress. And so Betty and Errol are illegitimate children of William Lee Childress.
Right.
And,
I mean, we assume Betty is.
Yeah.
I mean, she could have been a sister from a mother or something. We don't really know, but we assume.
Yeah. So we kind of, they have a very odd way of expressing sex that it's, we haven't made flowers in a while.
Yeah.
Or she does, at least.
Yeah, she wants him to make some flowers today.
Did you know what they meant? What she meant by that when you first heard it, the very first time?
Yes.
Well, kind of with dread in the back of your mind.
That's exactly it. I knew exactly what she was talking about. And he was kind of putting her off, and she's like calling him on it. You know, she's keeping score. You've not made flowers on me, not even with me, but on me in about 3 weeks. So... I don't know.
So we're mercifully relieved of this scene by going back to Cole and Hart, and they're back with Steve Geraci, and they're on the boat, and they make him watch the video.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a little bit of a relief. At least it's a video, and it's not the real thing. But at this point, we start to see that Geraci is not really the tough guy that he seems to be. He was just kind of following orders, and he was kind of a pawn in the mix of other people.
Right.
So that kind of gets him off the hook, I think, with Cole. Cole was ready, I think, to exact some justice on him.
Yeah, I mean, even after it was over, even though he believes him what he tells him, he still seems like he's second-guessing whether he wants to, or maybe he's just trying to scare him. I don't know, but he says it'd be easier for them, for Cole and Marty, if they just let, you know, make it look like an accident, do something with the Maserati.
Yeah, go off the bridge with the Maserati. Mm-hmm. So did you make the connection between William Lee Childress and the Childress that was Geraci's boss, Sheriff Childress?
Yeah. Yeah. Ted Childress. I mean, I didn't know the relation, but, I mean, with a name like Childress, I definitely assumed when they said that...
Well, that's what I mean, though. What was the relation?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know the relation to him. Because remember, he said, related to the Fontenots. That's what the sheriff, Ted Childress, said. I wasn't even sure if that was correct or not. I was going to ask you what you thought about that.
And then one of the guards of the guy that killed the pharmacist was also a Childress.
What pharmacist?
The guy that killed himself after he got the phone call from the payphone.
Oh, okay.
One of those guards, I think, was also a Childress.
Oh, I think you're right.
So anyway, there, Geraci gets as upset by the video almost as everyone else did. So that kind of makes him a little more human, although he's kind of a weasel. And he doesn't really have much of an excuse other than he was just doing what he was told to do. So he didn't have, he wasn't very much of a stand-up guy, but that was that. So they kind of got...
No, but I'm going to tell you, in his defense, if your boss said, this was made in error, I went out and interviewed the people, or I know the people and I know what happened, and that, I mean, would you go behind his back to research something if you had no reason to
do that? I think it let Geraci off the hook. It doesn't make me like Geraci anymore, though, than I do.
Oh, absolutely not.
So we see Errol painting the school, and the most innocent teacher in the world comes up to him and offers him a lunch. What an irony that was, huh? That he's got this bird's eye view of all the kids, and he's right there looming over them, and she's offering him lunch and being nice to him.
Yeah, why do you think they put that scene in there?
Just to show how he was always around the kids and that he had this fascination with kids. And they made a very interesting point in that scene where the little boy walked up and looked at him, and he was almost afraid of that little boy. He had fear in his eyes, I think, from that little boy.
Yeah, I kind of felt like he felt like the little boy could see him. And I think really the little boy was just seeing the scars and maybe interested / scared over the scars. But I think it was also showing that he's still around kids and he's still going to do damage. This isn't something that just happened a long time ago. And he even said earlier when he was talking to Betty in the house, he said he hasn't left his mark in weeks.
Right.
And I assume that's what he was talking about, right? Because it wasn't talking about flowers.
But I think he was a little he was a little unsettled by that little boy just being able to stand there and look at him and not be afraid. It kind of shook him up a little bit.
Was it that? Or do you think that he was so used to children staring at him that it really bothered him? And maybe that's part of the of his rage.
Maybe that's a good point, that that he was kind of a freak show and that little kids were fascinated by it. He didn't like that.
Yeah, I don't know, but true. I mean, he definitely didn't like the little boy. And did you notice he's the one that looked away first?
Yeah, Arrow looked away, yeah.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting.
So then, of course, like every other episode, these are jumping around a little bit between scenes and back and forth. But we get kind of the sniper nod to Breaking Bad. when Gerace's car gets pegged a little bit by this off-scene sniper.
Yeah, but he's being such an ass, you know? I mean, they said they're going to take his phone, take his gun. They just don't want him to call the authorities on him right then. And he shows himself, you know, even though he knows all this information and he's seen this tape and everything, he's still going to stand up and scream at them and tell them who he is and, you know, kind of bow up on them. And then Cole, you know, calls down the sniper on his Maserati.
Yeah. That sniper was a little more dangerous, though, than Badger and Pete.
Wow.
And also, I noticed for the first time on the rewatch that Marty didn't seem to know about the sniper. It was like Cole set it up. Marty was kind of ducking, like, holy crap, what's going on?
Oh, cool. I didn't notice that. In the many times I watched it, I did not notice that.
So then we came to a scene where I kind of saw a fault that I didn't really care for too much in this episode. It was the green ears part. Mm-hmm. Like, why did the guy have green ears?
Mm-hmm.
Was it the leaves? Was it in the woods? You know, why did he have green ears? And they kind of find out it was this greenhouse that had the fresh coat of paint. And I kind of always thought all along that a guy with a lawnmower having green ears was the mufflers that a guy cutting grass would wear.
Ooh.
Like the earmuffs, the big earmuffs.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess he just was painting the house and got paint on his ears, which is kind of dumb.
Yeah, I had remembered the little girl had called him the green spaghetti monster. I had just remembered that. And so I pictured maybe paint or something like that, or a mask, because back then we had no idea what they were talking about. But, that was, and particularly for Marty, that was a real stretch for him to think that far out of the box, I thought. Don't you?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, they figured it out and I got him closer to the scene. I remember thinking the spaghetti monster now that you just said that was when they showed Reggie as the monster.
Mm-hmm.
And when we didn't know it was Reggie, we didn't know really who that was,
because
he had his gas mask on or his air mask on.
Right. I never thought it was him.
That looked kind of like a spaghetti, little kid might call that look a spaghetti look or something.
Right. No, I always pictured something, I think, but I didn't know it was scarring or whatever, but something different than that.
Well, you're a true detective, Michelle, except for your notes.
Except for notepad. Hey, don't make fun of me. I'm still bitter over that.
So we see Cole and Hart in the car, and they talk a little bit about Maggie and what happened back then about Maggie and the fight. Yep. And Hart digs a little bit into Cole, like what happened, and Cole says, well, you pushed a good woman to use me, and Hart says, you had to want it a little bit. And then Gahard asked him the same question you asked me. Did you fight back during our fight?
Yeah, did you hold back any? And Cole is very kind. And he says he doesn't see how he could have. You know, I mean, he won't just out and out lie to him, I don't think. But he kind of says no. And
yeah,
that makes Marty mad. Marty's arrogant.
These are both evidence, more evidence of Marty's ego, like, you had to want my woman, admit it. You wanted it a little bit. And did you hold back or did I just kick your ass, completely? Did I dominate you and kick your ass? Like, those are painting Marty's view of his own ego.
That's a good point. Yeah, but Cole admits, that he did and that he blames Marty for his part in what happened back then as well.
Yeah, but I think that's why that scene was in there. It was like more, even so much time later, Marty's ego is still spilling out.
Yeah, but I think it was almost, even though it was his ego, and I agree with you, I think it was almost showing how vulnerable he felt. Because all that time, he had felt like Cole had held back. I think he really knew Cole had held back.
Well, if you have an overblown ego, you are fragile.
Yeah.
You need to reinforce it all the time. And if it's not, it's like devastating to you.
Yeah. It was pitiful.
So they follow up on the greenhouse deal, and they find, I guess, Lily Hill was her name. I think I got that somewhere.
That's
there.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Butch and Lily Hill. So they go and visit Lily, and she's in the old folks' home, and she remembers a lot about the house getting painted.
Yeah, she does. She remembers everything, basically, but the name of the people who did it. And did you happen to notice the cinematography in that? When they pulled up at that house, I mean, I know we've talked about this a time or two in various points, but they pulled up at this old greenhouse, and you can't even hardly tell it's green anymore. It almost looks gray. But they're getting out of the car, and the camera's panning down the side of the house past a window unit, air conditioning, and the paint's peeling, and the sun, the day, they're incredible with their camera.
You're talking about the greenhouse?
The greenhouse, yes. That doesn't even look green anymore. It's been so long. I just thought there were so many scenes in this that the cinematography of it just, it blew me away. And I don't know if I noticed it more in this one because it's the last one. And I'm just kind of trying to soak it all in because I know this is probably the last time I'll watch this or perhaps. But I'm just blown away by how well that's done. Remember we talked about like in episode 5 or whatever when they did that really long scene where they didn't take any cuts at all?
Yeah.
At the end of it. I mean, it's just incredible.
That was in 4.
Four, okay. Yeah. But it's incredible the stuff they've done. Anyway, sorry.
Yeah, I didn't even really catch the greenhouse getting some extra video attention.
Yeah, it did. They were like panning from the back part of the house, like the backyard, and they pan all the way up the side, and you can see big chunks of paint peeling off, and you can see Marty and Cole in the distance getting out of the car, and it's, the day is bright and beautiful, and the house is showing its age. We're seeing the difference in time, and I don't know, I just thought it was just incredible. Anyway, I'm sorry. So now we're in Abbeville, the old folks' home, and we're talking to Lily.
So she gives them all the dope on how the house got painted and the contractor and all that. And so the contractor was that William Lee Childress, the mummy guy strapped to the bed. But they find his address, and that's how they kind of come up on the house at the end of the show.
Mm-hmm.
But before they do that, Hart meets up with Papania and says that he's going to need some help. And I guess he wonders where Gilba is or something, or Papania asks why he wanted to just meet only him, and Hart says that he can read him better.
Mm-hmm. That he's able to read him, yeah, and not the other one. Yeah, I thought that was a pretty interesting scene, actually.
Yeah, I still say P&G committed the greatest sin of this whole series by missing out on Errol that when they drove past him.
No, Mike. I still say that they're no worse than Cole was back in the day, which he, has the regret over toward the end of the show.
Yeah, but Cole wasn't busy catching the wrong guys like they were trying to do.
I think their big sin was they didn't want to hear anything unless it had to do with Cole. they had already convicted Cole in their minds, and they just didn't want to hear anything else at all. So I didn't like that.
Well, that's kind of what I mean. It's they were so blind to what really was going on because of their pre-conclusion of Cole being guilty that they were bad cops.
Right, completely blind. And don't forget that in between this, we've flashed to a scene. It's a nighttime scene, and they don't show it, small mercies, of Betty making noises in a dark house, and Betty and Childress, and it's just awful. Do you remember that scene?
I might have blocked it out.
I'll have nightmares about it. And he says, they call the dog, I finally figured out, Miss Billy. And that was confusing to me at first because they call her Miss Betty, I think at points. But Miss Billy is the dog. And so it doesn't show them, but it shows a dark house and you can hear noises. You know what's going on. And you can hear Errol say, "Can you smell the flowers, Miss Billy?" And that it's unspeakable.
Well, I missed that, but thanks a lot for bringing it back to my attention.
Oh, sure. Mm-hmm. Oh, and then Cole gives all that incriminating evidence that he's got to the bar owner. Remember, and he says if they don't come back, pass it out or mail it, he's got it all sealed up, and he tells them what it is and everything. So he really does have a plan in place if something happens to them.
Yeah, mail it out unless I stop you.
Right. But Papania wants Marty to call him. You know, Marty's meeting with him, and he wants him to call him. I mean, he reluctantly wants him to. He said, "You're speaking riddles to me, white man." And I thought that was pretty good. And he points out that Marty sounds more and more like Cole. And I thought that was interesting because, remember, we had talked about that. I said in the last episode, I think, that I felt like Marty had kind of traded places with the old Cole. Of course, Cole, I think, had sunk even deeper. But then when Papania said it, he sounded like Cole, more than once he said that, so...
Yeah, I don't know. I still like thinking of them as two different people, Hart and Cole.
Well, I just think that it's because Marty disliked so much how Cole was, and because he tried to change him and all that kind of stuff, and then to see him almost become Cole, at least in his outward circumstances, his circumstances became Cole's. I think there's some kind of poeticness in that.
But. Yeah, maybe. So Hart asks Papania if he'll be their backup if they need to call in cavalry and help, and he kind of reluctantly agrees, like, "Don't call anyone else, call me, I want the credit for it."
Mm-hmm.
So they end up showing up at this house, and Cole tastes the same tastes and aluminum and ash that he did in the first episode, and I guess he's having his synesthesia happen to him. And he kind of knows. He tells Marty this, you know, this is the place.
Yeah, he does. And he admitted to Marty, too, that he still sees things. Remember when he told GMP that he didn't? They asked him if he still had visions and stuff. Yeah. And he told them he didn't. And he admits it here to Marty, which I like, because I felt like it showed that he was completely honest with Marty through everything. And I think we kind of knew that anyway. But yeah. I really like that here. I think it just kind of reinforced that.
Well, they make a couple strategic, stupid moves, I think, here. Like, why did they go in without calling? As soon as they found out they didn't have a cell signal, get back in the car, drive half a mile back up the road. Nobody else is going to come up the road. Nobody's going to escape past you. Make a call and get back up. But they decide not to. They decide to split up. And Cole checks the back shed while Marty goes to the house.
Yeah, I particularly since they weren't police anymore, I'm not sure how I felt about that. Although I think it's viable if you look at it because they were detectives.
Well, they tried to. They would have if they had a phone signal.
No. I'm just saying I think that I can buy that they would have done that because of their past actions and how they might have handled things. But I think considering that they're both, you know, private investigator, Marty's a private investigator now, and Cole's doing his own investigation. I don't know. I thought it was like really a step out of bounds to do that. Not just out of bounds, but, you know, something that seemed out of place. So I agree with you.
So they, I guess the first thing we see is Marty getting to the house and talking to Betty. And he asks her where old Bill is. And she doesn't answer. And he shouts at her, well, who do you live with?
Yeah, well, she says he's in the shed. Remember?
Yeah, she then she ultimately says he's all around us. Before you were born and after you die.
Yep.
And then she catches on to Marty being not some surveyor like he claims, but that he's some threat to her and tells him to get out of my house.
Mm-hmm.
So did you, when you saw Cole walking back by the, to the back there, did you try to figure out those symbols? You said you saw a lot of them and the whole place was covered with symbols and writing.
Well, I saw some, not right then. I saw some later when Marty went in there. But yeah, some of the stuff said Yellow King and stuff like that. That was the only thing I was able to make out. I was watching on a really small screen.
Did it take away from the value of the scene for you that you didn't know what they meant? That they were unexplained?
Ooh, good question. I don't know that it took away because I didn't think about it, but thinking about it, if I could have known, I think I would have loved it. And also, was that supposed to be written in his blood? Do we know that?
Oh, I don't know.
Because I kind of got the feeling of that as crudely as it was written, but his body wasn't opened up in such a way.
No, he was mummified. His mouth was sewn shut. He was not in any position to have blood.
No. But I mean, in the past, you know, like.
No, I don't know.
What I saw this was every time he was tortured, that Errol wrote something in his blood. Now, that's just me, but that's what I saw.
That's a cheerful little thought.
Well, yeah. That's what went through my mind after I figured out it actually was words. So it just seemed like this just huge magnitude of torture that the man would lay there and view, knowing what was coming again. But I mean, you know, we have to remember who this man is. He's the man who evidently had deliberately done this to his kid's face.
Yeah.
But still, it was just horrific.
So, Michelle, what is scented meat?
Oh, that's not what he said. He said something else. But gosh, he was saying the craziest things. You know, he's doing like this big diatribe, and Marty just hears one thing, and he mishears it.
So, yeah. This is why I don't like to think of Marty becoming Cole, because Marty could never become Cole.
No, Marty didn't become Cole mentally, but Marty's physical surroundings deteriorated to what Cole's were that Marty detested from before. But I do think they showed him kind of becoming Cole, because he figured out the greenhouse and he was doing this more intuitive kind of investigating that Cole had done in the past. And I really saw it, but maybe I just kind of wanted to see it. I'm not sure.
Yeah, Marty's the guy who thinks he's going to try to figure out what scented meat is. That's how I always think of Marty. So what did you think of Errol's disembodied voice when they were walking through the stage Carcosa?
Okay, I got to tell you, at first I wasn't sure if that was his voice or if Cole was having a hallucination, because I didn't understand, and I still don't really understand how the voice could have come like that. And I realized the surroundings and the fact that it was half underground and half above ground, and there was a courtyard and all the different doorways. I get the whole thing. But the way his voice was coming, it was almost seemed like it was a voice in Cole's head.
Yeah, I think that was Errol. It was his home turf. He knew all the angles and he knew what to do. And that thing was a total maze of sticks and twigs and bodies and it was a warren of different tunnels.
Yeah, you know, and I think it was a... Yeah.
He knew where to go and how to make it all work. And so, you know, he's saying, come on, follow me, little man, little priest.
Why was he calling him that?
Because I think my philosophy of all this is that Errol wanted to die. Errol and, like, Reggie Ledoux and those guys, they were, like, happy to die. Remember, Reggie was not that upset when he was kneeling and about to be shot. And he didn't know he was about to be shot. But he wasn't that upset about, like, his time ending. And I believe that that's how they thought that they would escape this circle, the flat circle. They had to do these evil sacrifices and these evil deeds, and that got them out of the, you know, the never-ending cycle of being in the same flat circle. And that was their glory. That was like their heaven.
Okay.
And so, in a way, Cole was a little priest helping Errol reached that goal. I don't think Errol planned to live through this. He kind of knew that his time was up, but he was kind of happy.
Well, he acted like he wanted to live through it, though. And but you're right, though. He did say, "Come die with me, little priest."
Yeah.
And you're like, ooh.
That maze that they were in is a state park in Louisiana. That's a real place you could go if you wanted to and see it.
Yeah, I actually had that pulled up on my computer before it died, and I lost everything. But yeah, I saw that.
So we see the yellow skeleton king, this set of bones that's painted yellow.
It was horrible. And in the meanwhile, Marty and Cole are hollering to one another, kind of trying to find their placement. And I think, like what you were saying, the voices are carrying in different ways and everything. And then Marty comes upon that. Remember the head high stack, huge stack of people's clothes, children's clothes and shoes and stuff.
Yep.
And he's just horrified.
Well, you could see a couple mummified bodies in and among those twigs too.
Yeah, I thought that's what some of it was. I wasn't 100% sure because so much was set up to look like that. But then when they got back and there were skulls and stuff, that looked pretty real. Although they looked awfully small, and that was real disturbing.
Well, that's because they're kids.
I know, but I don't like that.
So Cole does, this is one of the Pizzolatto things where I think he purposely leaves it like, is this in Cole's head? Is he really seeing this? Is this really mystical? Is it really happening? Is it imagined? Mm-hmm. You know, whatever.
Right.
But Cole sees the swirling stars in the firmament kind of twisting around and this really cool unusual scene, and we kind of wonder, like, what the heck is going on here? Like, is it real? Right. Is it in his head? So I don't know that that ever really gets answered, but I choose to believe that that's Cole's interpretation of what all these different things around him are doing in his head.
Yeah, I definitely thought it was a vision, and I think it distracted Cole that time, where most of his visions that he's had have been real meaningful, and I felt like this one kind of distracted him, and I didn't really know how I felt about that.
Do you think Cole was the only one to see that?
I do. I thought he was, because he was taken aback by it, and there was nobody else in there except Errol, and Errol, which we didn't know at that point, and Errol wasn't distracted by it, and how could you not be distracted by that?
So do you think Cole saw his daughter and his father in the swirly thing or in his coma?
No, I think it was in his coma. I don't think it was there.
So Errol says, take off your mask.
Yeah. Well, he impales him and then lifts him off the ground with this huge knife through Cole's liver.
Yeah, he got him pretty good with the knife, but he also whacked him with a hammer.
Well, that hatchet thing, right. Right, well, yeah, I mean, he tries to, but Cole kind of blocks that. But then he, I mean, how do you live when you're physically lifted from the bottom of your abdomen up through your liver and lifted off your feet? And I think that was odd, too, because this is really showing Errol with an incredible amount of strength.
Well, he's gigantic. He's just really big.
Yeah, but one-handed lifting a guy on a knife?
Yeah. But the take off your mask was part of the King in Yellow story by Robert Chambers. One part of that story is they have this party and everybody, you know, the thing is they all take off their masks. And in the story, the horror payoff is the one guy at the end, they say, take off your mask. And he says, I wear no mask. Like his gruesome face was really his face.
Ooh, that's pretty bad.
So we see Marty saves Cole, and then Cole saves Marty with mm-hmm. some strategic shots to Errol.
Mm-hmm.
And Cole's shot takes Errol out by hitting him in the head, and then...
Yeah, his head explodes with that one. And so, this is after Marty's gotten, like, a hatchet thrown through his lung. Are these guys, like, indestructible or what?
No. Because, I have a hard time believing Cole surviving the gutting he took. But Marty could have just taken that hatchet in, like, his shoulder and chest.
It was in the middle of his chest. It was no doubt through his lung. I mean, no doubt through his lung.
Well,
I don't know
lived.
How he could have missed it. Well, you can live, but not only did he lived and fought him. And then Cole is over there trying to pull this huge samurai-like blade out of his liver, which we all know that if you're impaled on something, you shouldn't remove it yourself, right? Because
yeah.
it can be stopping the blood flow, and he ought to know better than that.
Well, I thought that was the end of Cole. We were just kind of seeing his last movement, and that was going to be the end of him.
Yeah, but, you know, Cole's going, you know, I'm cut bad. And what's Marty say? What all the guys say. See, here's Marty still lying. And I mean, I guess it's an okay lie, but he goes, oh, it ain't bad.
Just a scratch.
Yeah. Yeah. It ain't bad. And literally, you can see like his life's blood pumping out of him.
So, how do you think the cops made it there?
Oh, I think Marty found the phone. I think there was a phone, and I think he found it from Betty. Remember, he went inside, and she was up in some kind of bathroom, bedroom. I don't know what that was. And she's giggling, remember? And he went to her. And
yeah,
he's like, everybody's got a phone. Where's your phone?
Yeah, but we didn't see any phone. We didn't see that answer.
No, but he put a gun to her head and grabbed her hair. And she's crying and screaming no. And I think she turned over the phone. That's
yeah,
what I
wondered
thought.
If she called or if Marty called. But I guess Marty probably had to call.
Yeah,
and you knew they had a phone line because they did have the one phone that wasn't connected,
exactly.
Which they would have never had if they didn't have a phone line.
Right.
So that at first didn't add up, but I guess on reflection, it does kind of make sense.
Yeah, she had to have turned that over to him. I mean, she had nothing to, you know, there was no reason not to at that point.
So G&P shoot off their flares and they save them and they find all the evidence matches the previous crimes, and this, so they kind of see that, you know, this was the solution to everything they were looking for. And then, so Marty sees his family in the hospital. How did you like that scene?
You know, I've told you that I had to watch this 3 extra times, right? And every time I watched that scene, I cried. Every time. And that made me so mad. I hate that. I was really moved by that. Harrelson put on the most incredible acting job in that scene than I think he did in the whole thing. And I think he was brilliant because we didn't like him, but he was brilliant as an actor. But in this, I felt his gratitude and his love for his family. And I felt his, you know, he says he didn't expect him to come. And he breaks down. I think it's the only time we see him truly break down. And I just feel like he was so genuine. And the only part of that that really irked me as far as a, like, thorn in that scene was when Maggie reaches out to take his hand and she does it very slowly. And it's the wedding ring she's wearing as she reaches out to take his hand. And he's crying. And it was just, I swear I could tear up thinking about it. It is so
Do you
sad.
Think it was it harder for Marty to see the children that he kind of lost his family and lost his children, connection with his children, or harder for Cole when he thought about his daughter?
I I think Marty loved seeing his girls. I think that's why I didn't understand the disconnect with them before, and I'll never understand that. I don't think they explained that well. Pure and simple, I don't think they explained him being this father who would beat up boys for his daughter because he cared so much about her well-being. And I do believe that's why he did that, to disappearing and not even knowing what was going on. I didn't buy that part of it.
Well, he beat up the boys because of his ego. Like, you can't do this to me. Doing this to my daughters is doing this to me. And he lost his family because he was weak.
I get that, but I just didn't buy you're this invested and then you're not invested. I don't buy that. And particularly with this scene, I felt like he was genuine in his...
Well, he was.
In his love lifelong, of seeing his daughters.
It's a universal lesson, Michelle. I think that you miss what you don't have once it's gone way more than when you have it. And that was a perfect reflection of that.
Well, that's fair enough. I just, for me, I don't buy that. I just don't buy the whole thing.
So we see the news anchor talking about how the FBI discredited all the rumors of the higher ups getting caught up in this thing, which was kind of shitty. Then we come across Cole, and Cole is gloriously Christ-like in his bed. But I was kind of surprised to see him alive at that point. So even though he looked like crap, it was kind of good that he was alive.
Well, I didn't know he could look worse than he had, because we had already talked about how the years of bartending and alcoholism hadn't been kind to him. But they definitely showed me that I was wrong in that. But what do you mean, like, he was Christ-like? What do you mean by that?
Well, he was like the long hair and, you know, thin, gaunt. You know, he looked like Christ in the, you know, after he was resurrected. He just looked like a Christ figure.
That didn't dawn on me at all. I didn't get that at all. But he did look like he had definitely been through the ringer, though. And he looked horrible. I mean, just so bad. He looked like he had been gutted with a big knife through the liver is kind of what he looked like. But
so Hart visits Cole, and they're right back in their old mode, you know.
Yeah, that was sweet. I kind of like that.
And then Cole shows his true feelings where he says, you know, I saw Errol on Pelican Island back in 95 and I let him go. So he's haunted by that.
And yeah, and he's upset that they didn't get them all. And Marty's like, it's okay. But it's okay with Marty, but it's not okay with Cole.
So then we see a flyover of all the old scenes. Of the crimes and of the places the criminals hung out and stuff.
Yeah,
that was pretty cool.
It was more cinematography. Didn't you love that? They showed the tree, the beginning tree, the Dorlang tree in the cornfields, and then they even showed it with the sun setting. It was spectacular. These aerial views of this stuff. I was just impressed.
But you're right. This scene was happening. This whole episode was happening pretty quickly because we have some time left. And so we see Hart's better and Cole's getting better, and they're starting to talk to each other. And they're outside, and Cole gets a present from Hart.
And it's in like a Tiffany box. Did you notice the color? That's like a Tiffany color. That's, I think, the Tiffany blue. Yeah. And so, you know, you think, what is this? And then, you know, it's a pack of Camels.
I remember thinking that the best presents that you get are not good presents. Like, the best presents you get are the silly ones that aren't, like, valuable ones. Because they're valuable in meaning and not in material value.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it meant a lot to Cole. I think that might have even contributed to his breaking down with Marty and telling him everything. I think that's the first time that we see them being close. We've seen it kind of edge toward that way. But then they really start asking each other these personal questions and answering, not just asking, but asking and answering. So
we kind of come to the meaning of the whole series, and it's a great topic. You know, it's the ultimate story, light versus dark. Mm-hmm. And that is darkness getting darker and winning, or is light coming back to take, you know, to redeem us a little bit and save us a little bit?
How they could have ended that better. I thought that was beautiful. I thought that was really good.
Yeah, and there's always a little bit of dark, like, that gets away. Like, it, that the story totally reminded me of No Country for Old Men, when Anton Chigurh, no matter what they did, they shot him and they rammed him with a car in a car accident. He still survived. He's still going to creep around. He's still going to be in the world. And the evil that got away in this series is still there. You know, it never stops. But we all have a duty to confront it in our own little way and stop a little bit of it.
That's sweet. I like that.
And that's kind of what Hart said. You know, like you said, he said, we didn't get them all, but it's okay. We did a little bit. We did what we could, and we stopped what we could of it.
Right. Yeah, he said, we got ours, meaning their part, I think.
Yeah.
And yeah, but to Cole, I don't think that's ever going to be good enough. Cole wants to end it. He wants to end the badness.
Well, Cole wanted to end his part in the play.
I think he did, but I also think he really cared. That's why he did all this. He did it off the clock. He did it when he was suspended. He did it the whole time. He didn't have to do that. He could have hung out at a bar and drank, but he didn't. He still worked the case. He still wanted to stop the bad. Stop the dark.
To a certain point, but at one point he was very nihilistic, like, everything's just crap. Doesn't matter. We're all in a circle. It's going to repeat and repeat and repeat. I'm just going to get out of it. Whatever I do doesn't mean anything.
Yeah, you know? I think he was talking, though, don't you? Because his actions weren't showing that. I think that's what he felt. But I think as long as he was alive, he was compelled.
Well, I think we saw him go through a process where he was like that, and then he kind of evolved into this better state where he was actually, you know, he had to live with himself, and he had this realization that I am who I am, and I've got, you know, I've kind of seen this positive hope that there may be something of value in my daughter and my daddy, and I may see them somehow again, or they may have a part of my memory, or, you know, whatever that meaning is that he uncovered in this final episode.
Oh, well, he said he felt them. They were there. I mean, he was really clear. It wasn't a I may or anything. He said he wasn't supposed to be there. He was supposed to be with them. He was really clear, I thought, with all that, that he could feel his daughter and he could feel his dad and everything he had ever loved, he was a part of it when he left here.
Yeah, I mean, that was his interpretation. That was a valuable part of the show, but I'm still looking at that as his interpretation. And it makes me reflect on my interpretation, not like, oh, that's the answer. Cole delivered the answer. It's just one part of an answer that we all have to interpret ourselves and figure out ourselves.
Absolutely, but I think Cole coming to that point was just a beautiful thing. He breaks down, he starts, Cole, we're not even talking about Marty here, we're talking about Cole, and he starts sobbing, and he's so moved by what happened to him, and it's just, it's incredible to me. I thought they ended that perfectly. I was so glad he lived. Were you?
Well, I mean, it was good that he lived and he didn't just extinguish his life in this nihilism and go out like a flame going out.
Right.
So we talked about this a bunch of times. So this Carcosa, what does Carcosa mean to you now that you've seen the whole thing and you've got a whole 360 degree perspective of it?
Well, I mean, Carcosa, in the way they use it, certainly means that, I mean, not certainly, but I think it means their religious place, whatever that was, and I use that term religious loosely, but I think that was their voodoo, their, I don't even know the word I want to use, Mike. I think it was their, what they viewed as the end. What did you think?
When you say they, you mean who?
The people who practiced, who believed in this specific thing. The people who practiced this ritualistic whatever it was to begin with.
I think Carcosa to me is the black and the dark and the dark versus light. It's the void. It's like the answers you don't have. Like the lover you lost, you don't know why. The space left behind by a dead child. Like, why did this child die? You know, why did this child have to get killed? The unanswered mysteries that we have. It's this dark place that just we have to live with. You know, there isn't an answer that cleans up everything tight in a tidy way.
So is that what you took from it, or what you think they meant from
it? That's what I'm taking from it.
Okay.
It's in a way it's evil, but it's there. It's just a part of life, you know? It's not going to ever be cleaned up in a neat way. It's just kind of a crappy part of life that we all have to manage. There will be places that are dark that don't have answers that we have to venture into sometimes, and they're scary. But in our search for these answers, we do our best to try to find what the meaning is, but we may not always find the total answer.
And you think that's why Errol, when Cole was walking into that fortress there at the end, said, "Welcome to Carcosa"?
Yeah.
Like this maze of the unknown kind of?
Yeah. Okay. It's a place in your mind, you know. It's not a physical place. It's a way of thinking.
I can follow what you're saying.
Yeah, so that's it. So they kind of limped away together, and Marty says, "I'm going to help you get back on your feet." And Cole says, "You don't have to worry about taking care of that." And Marty says, "It's already taken care of." So, you know, they're kind of friends, you know, they're bound together till whatever ends up separating them permanently, but they're pretty good friends, and they kind of leave us with that feeling.
Yeah. And Cole, you know, he wants to break out of the hospital at the very end, you know, Marty's helping him break out, and he's like limping away in his hospital gown, you know, with the back of it flapping open and everything, although they don't show that. But, you know, Marty says, "I'd protest, but it appears you're unkillable." And I thought that was a great, like, little last parting shot. And then when Cole says, because Marty had previously said that it looked like the darkness was winning because they're looking up at the skies and everything. And then Cole says, "You're looking at it wrong. Once there was only dark. So if you ask me, the light is winning." And that's like the last statement. Yeah, I love that. And then it just fades to black.
Yep, that was pretty neat.
I liked it.
So that's it. That's the end of this thing.
The end.
I found an Easter egg on somewhere, and it's a scene that got deleted from the show, and it's about Cole and Lori breaking up, why they broke up. It's a 3-minute video about why Cole and his girl Lori broke up.
Oh.
Lori was the girl that Maggie set up Cole with back in the middle of this whole thing.
Well, yeah, and they had a relationship for a while, right?
Yeah. I think they were married.
They married?
Well, I don't know if they were married, but they were living together.
Yeah. Can you link to that?
Do you want to guess why they broke up?
Oh. Well, let me think. Okay, because Cole says that he gave her every reason. So my guess would be, just guessing, that it's because he was so hyper-focused on this negativity, on this evilness, on this darkness that we've talked about in the whole thing, that she couldn't tolerate it. That'd be my guess.
It's actually because Cole didn't want to have kids, and she wanted to have kids. Yeah. But I'll put a link to it in the episode, and it's 2 minutes and 50 seconds. You can watch it.
I'm glad they cut that, because I don't know if I'd buy that or not. I mean, I do buy it. I buy it because Cole has actually said that he thinks the whole human population should just stop reproducing, right? He actually said that. So back then, maybe. But I don't know. I kind of want to think he doesn't feel that way.
All right, I won't put it in.
No, put it in. I want to see it.
Okay, well, that's it, Michelle. Till the next, till our carcasses are bound together in the future for another podcast. That's the end of the end.
If that's how we have to put it, that's how we'll put it.
Do you see a big swirly above your head?
Oh, let me look. No. No, I don't. Do you?
Nope.
Okay, good.
All right. Well, I'll talk to you next time.
Okay, Mike.